From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Bill Nygut. Today, the announcement that President Biden will give the commencement speech at Morehouse College is ramping up concerns that protests and walkouts could greet his visit. Will administrators keep tensions under control?
I'm Tia Mitchell in Washington. Governor Kemp has now signed the most far-reaching school voucher bill ever passed by the legislature.
This legislation has always been about one thing: providing every Georgia child the opportunity to get the education that they deserve.
We'll look at the controversy that this measure continues to provoke.
Plus, a new Fox News poll shows Donald Trump with a 5-point edge over Joe Biden here in Georgia, but other polls have Biden gaining ground nationally and in some key states. We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Welcome to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Politically Georgia. We have a lot to talk about on the show today. I'm Bill Nygut, joined by co-host Tia Mitchell in Washington. How you doing, Tia?
I'm doing great. Ready to get into another awesome show.
Yeah, we do have a lot to talk about. And a little later in the show, I'm really looking forward to hearing your take on the way the Georgia delegation voted on the big funding package, which is now passed the Senate as well as the House for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. And we'll get to that a little bit later in the show. But we're going to start today by talking with Maureen Downey, whose column Get Schooled is a wonderful way to learn about what's happening in this state in terms of education. Maureen, we're so happy you could be with us today because we want to talk to you about Governor Kemp's signing now of the school voucher law. But because we have you on this morning and because you're a graduate of the graduate school at Columbia University, I thought, and because you do cover higher education in your column, tell us a little bit about how you're reflecting upon what you're seeing first at your former university. And then what you think about what's going to happen at Morehouse with President Biden coming.
First of all, good morning to all and good morning to the listeners. I went to Columbia during the height of the protest season. You know, I was there in 78, where it was a constant sight. There were always students on the South Lawn. There was always a protest table. There was always sort of chanting. And it was sort of the backdrop of my experience as a graduate student there. The one difference was back then, the protest was to issues external to the campus in a way. I mean, all the students were sort of behind the protest because they were about something else that didn't really impact students. They were about, at that point, divesting from South Africa. It was about Columbia's using its brain power to help the Pentagon. So it was kind of issues that students cared about to varying degrees, but I don't think necessarily took personally. And I think what's so different about what's happening now is at that campus and campuses here in Georgia as well, is that the protests really affect some students very deeply. I mean, there are Jewish students who feel that these protests are aimed at them. And it's much more complicated when universities have to face the fact that their job is to make learning. Learning is the most important thing. Kids have to be comfortable. Students have to feel safe. And I think that there is legitimate concern that that is not the case right now, due to the sort of how polarized this issue is, Israel and Hamas, and the nature of the protest. I mean, there's a, you know, people are scrawling anti-Semitic messages on walls, on the sidewalk. The kids are, students at Columbia are getting it when they leave the campus as well. They're in a very vibrant, large neighborhood, diverse neighborhood. So I do think it's, I don't want to see protests stop on campus. They've been happening since, you know, we all of us went to college. However, I think that the number one responsibility of any university is to ensure that the learning environment is safe for its students.
Yeah,
and that's all of its students. And that's the dilemma here. If kids aren't feeling safe at Columbia, the president, in my view, had to act.
You know, Tia, we don't want to overblow this. We don't want to go too far in assuming we're going to see a lot of trouble. Certainly not like what's happening at Columbia, we hope. But we do have to be aware of the fact that the president's visit here is certainly likely to spark, at the very least, protests. But we just don't really know how Morehouse might react to it. There's already been calls for walkouts when he speaks and that sort of thing. But as Maureen points out, that's sort of not unusual on college campuses. We just don't want it to spiral out of control here.
Well, protests are not unusual on college campuses, period. Protests are not unusual on the AUC, the Atlanta University Center. You know, Mayor Dickens has had a hard time with his public appearances at the AUC recently because of protests over the Public Safety Training Center. So, again, the question is how widespread and how organized and how disruptive the protest may or may not be. You know, there's really no way to knowing because those who possibly are organizing something probably won't be talking much about it ahead of time. I will say that President Biden is also used to, you know, being heckled or having people yell out things or try to disrupt his speeches that happened at his big fundraiser in Madison Square Gardens a couple of weeks ago. It happened, quite frankly, even in Charleston when he was in the church commemorating the anniversary of a very deadly mass shooting. So I think probably the people around him are more worried about it than he is because he tends to take it in stride. But again, the question is probably how disruptive. The other thing is there are going to be, I think we have to remember that there is no monolith on either any side of these debates. And Maureen mentioned that,
yes.
You know, there are plenty of people who don't think that Israel is treating the people of Gaza very well and that there's been overkill and there's genocide going on in Gaza, but they're not shouting down anti-Semitic remarks at every Jewish person they see. And there are people who also might not be happy with what's going on for whatever reason, but don't think interrupting graduation where so many students, first generation students, are celebrating this milestone. So it's not like people are going to be on one accord one way or another.
All right. Well, we will be paying close attention to developments at Morehouse in the days ahead and certainly talk a lot more about it from a public safety and a political, certainly a political point of view. So thank you both for that. Maureen, let's get to school vouchers. Let me just make sure that I lay out just very, very fundamental facts here. What Governor Kemp signed into law yesterday is the most wide-ranging voucher bill or law that the state has ever seen. We already have a couple of voucher programs that are very limited in scope. This one essentially offers an opportunity for just about any student to get a $6,500 annual a stipend. They're calling it a scholarship. It's a stipend. But the condition is that their school has to be in the lower 25% of public school performances in the state. I think I'm right that the law sets 1% as the amount of money that would go to this voucher every year, based 1% of the total state funding for school, and that's 140 or so million this first year. All that said, Maureen, give us a sense of, as this is enacted, given that there's been a lot of controversy, given the teachers, many of them are unhappy about it, given that there are people in public schools, you know, families that don't like what's happening here, what do you expect we're going to see as this unfolds, as the fall semester comes up next year and beyond?
You know, I think what we're going to see initially is that the law will have these limits in place, and we'll probably see the greatest usage in Metro Atlanta of this law. For the simple reason, there are existing private schools here, and so parents won't have to sort of search high and low the way they will in rural Georgia. I think what we are going to see, if other states are models for us, is that we will see the limits fall to the wayside as time goes on. Because, frankly, these bills, these voucher bills, have their greatest appeal to middle-class parents. And so we'll probably see some kind of tweaking of the caveat that you have to be in a low-performing school. Eventually, we'll probably see, I think, most of the limits removed, because if you follow the voucher debate, the argument wasn't sort of let's help a targeted number of students. The argument was parent rights, mm-hmm. that we are shifting from public school being a public good to it being sort of an option. And so given how they presented vouchers and their the underpinnings behind, you know, with vouchers, I suspect we will see attempts at expansion over the next few years. Because I think the folks who are fighting for the voucher bill, which was only there's only a small support there for the voucher bill. These were middle class. These are legislators in middle class communities. I think they have plans to eventually ramp this up, and we will see more eligibility for vouchers in the state of Georgia, I would suspect, in 5 to 7 years.
This is a foot in the door, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Tia?
So along those lines, Maureen, you know, one of the criticisms of voucher expansion is that not just that there's a class divide where vouchers tend to be perceived as helping middle-class families be able to select, you know, private schools or, you know, schools that aren't necessarily their neighborhood schools, but that there's often a racial divide. Like when you see vouchers championed, it's often championed as help poor kids not have to attend failing schools. And what's unsaid is often, you know, poor Black kids are attending failing schools. But there's a perception, a criticism, I guess, of vouchers that it helps middle class, often white children, separate themselves from public schools that tend to be more diverse. Is that something that you think is a valid criticism?
Yeah, I do think it's a valid criticism, because this is a voucher that is $6,500. For those of you in Metro Atlanta who have ever looked at private school tuition here, you will get nothing for $6,500 in Metro Atlanta, nothing of quality. You're talking $20,000, $30,000 a year now for the most esteemed and most successful private schools. So, you know, I think that the $6,500 as it stands right now, remember, there's no limit on the parent. You know, the parents can get vouchers if their child attends one of these schools that has a certain number of underperforming students. It doesn't mean that the kids who will use those vouchers from that school are underperforming or having any issues in school at all. They simply have to have parents who can contribute to that $6,500 to afford a private school in Metro Atlanta. The other issue here, and this is one that I am almost certain we will be reporting on in 1 to 3 years, and that is the misuse of that $6,500, because you don't just use it for private school tuition under the bill. You can use it for a whole slew of things related to homeschooling. And that's where the abuses surfaced in Arizona, which had a great deal of new restraints put on the spending, because parents were essentially using that money for almost anything, because the follow-up, the accountability really wasn't in place. They had a panel, as we will have a panel, but the panel really didn't do good follow-through. They didn't question. They weren't in a position to really know how to track down these parents and sort of figure out and get their justifications for how they could spend $6,500, on a tanning salon. So in any event, we have that issue here as well. So I do think that $6,500 is... Bill, you said get their foot in the door. They didn't want a kick in the door, which is what they would have to do to give a legitimate voucher in the state of Georgia. It would have to be at least, frankly, $10,000 to $15,000 for even, the small church-based schools. And what I'm worried about is what one of the proponents said, that don't worry, if it's $6,500, the market will respond. Some smart folks will figure out how to deliver an education for $6,500 a year, and that will be the price. And I have no doubt that will happen. That happened in Wisconsin, and the majority of those schools that sprang up in response to their voucher have all closed now because they couldn't sustain on that money, and they were terrible schools. So I think Georgia is going to have 5-10 years, or the education team at the AJC is going to have 5 to 10 years of incredibly frustrating stories about the misuse of the vouchers.
Maureen, correct me if I'm wrong, but $6,500, am I right? That now is the state supplement. That's what every student essentially gets from the state, or is given for each student to a school, to a public school. And that money moves with the student. So if my child is in one of those low performing schools and I say, well, I'm going to find a school that's going to take them and I can figure out a way to pay for it, that $6,500 is taken away from the public school, right?
Well, it's taken away from the state funding, but ultimately, yes.
I understand that the county is that the school systems are, of course, major funders of schools. But my point is, you are now shortchanging public schools to give these families the opportunity to send their child to a private school. And in the long run, that's one of the reasons that teachers, in many cases, are so concerned about what this does. Rather than make the public schools that are underperforming, give them enough to get better, you're now taking money away from them, right?
Yes, that is absolutely true. And, I think there's a greater issue here that is sort of hard to get to, but that is what makes me sad about the voucher bill in Georgia and the fact that we held off so long. In fact, we're coming in at the tail end when almost all the research is negative about vouchers, about voucher programs at a state level. But we are reducing our commitment to public education. Mm-hmm. And I really believe public education is transforms lives to this day. And it's our public education system that was the envy of most of the world, because it really created an opportunity for before people didn't have that option. And not only that, the schools became the center of communities. And I think that we will lose something when we devalue our public schools. And I will not mince words on this. These voucher bills are truly a devaluing of our public schools. And it's really a rewriting sort of the fabric of what we believe in this country. We believe that public schools were important, had to be preserved, had to be supported. And frankly, when you look at the states that outperform us, it's not Arizona with a voucher bill. It's the New England states that have long better funded their public schools. And in fact, many of them have stayed away from these fad things like vouchers. They have simply invested in better teachers, smaller classes. And I wish Georgia would, I wish we'd look at what works rather than what doesn't work, what's prone to abuse. And that's what we run to adopt here in Georgia, the ones that are most problematic, because they're on the right political spectrum. I mean, this is a political decision. I'm not sure, you know, if you folks talk to a lot of your neighbors, but I didn't know anybody clamoring for vouchers.
So, Maureen, you kind of went straight to what I was going to ask you about, which is, again, this criticism that vouchers are part of a larger scheme, a larger, I guess, endeavor to dismantle or greatly disrupt the public education system. And our listeners know I often reference where that was my background before I moved to Georgia. And in Jacksonville, their school board is saying they might have to close some really high rated public schools because of funding. And a lot of people are saying, see, this is what is the havoc that vouchers and charter school access wrecks over years, because I would say Florida is a good 10 to 15 years ahead of Georgia when it comes to wider access to vouchers and charter schools, maybe 20 or 30 years ahead of Georgia. So can you just talk a little bit more about what do you think could be the long-term effects on public education if, you know, there's a way to siphon dollars away from public schools?
Well, I do think that there are some folks who ultimately want to see the dismantling of public education in Georgia and in the country. They simply don't believe in it. Now they've layered on top of their belief that private is better. They've also now come in with the idea that public schools are indoctrinating students, which, of course, that's a whole nother topic for us. But we have this whole craziness going on now where school libraries are under attack, school librarians. So there really is. You know, when I first began reporting on this, and folks would say to me, this is the plot, you know, to overthrow public education, to destroy it. And I would think, nah, this is just an isolated nutcase here doing this. And, you know, a small group of angry grandparents, because it's often older people behind these culture war things, they're the ones who show up. But now I'm beginning to wonder if, in fact, they are correct. This is a larger plot here. This is a larger storyline of sort of invalidating public schools, of talking to parents about all the wonderful options they can do with the $6,500, but also casting public schools as the enemy, as anti-American values, as something that needs to be monitored, contained, and ultimately, I think, minimized. And that will be a tragedy, because I think public schools were an incredible idea. And when you go into rural Georgia, which will get very little out of this voucher bill, again, very few options out there in private schools, but the public schools are still the center of those towns. They are still how people get to know each other. They are still, well, you know, their basketball games, their football games, they're well attended. And I think we will lose something with that. We will, you know, we'll become the kind of America where people don't believe you need community centers, don't believe you need county sponsored day camps, because parents can just go onto the marketplace and, you know, find private day camps. These community investments, I think, really are important to kind of connect people, to create civic engagement. And I really worry about the loss of that. And public schools would be the greatest loss.
Tia, you're muted. Are you there? Yeah, we've lost your audio.
There's some construction noise. Sorry about that. There's some construction noise. You guys know I record from my closet. There's a little construction noise, so I turned my mic down. But Maureen, I wanted to ask, along those lines, why do you think some lawmakers, which in rural areas of Georgia, they tend to be Republicans, but not all, but Democrats generally didn't support the voucher bill. Republicans did. Why in rural areas would they support this bill, knowing that there's not a lot of benefit in where they represent?
You know, I think that when we saw the voucher bill defeated in 2023, that was the reason that the Metro Atlanta Republicans could not strong arm the rural Republicans at that point into going for a bill that didn't bring much at all to their community. And in fact, ultimately, I think will hurt their community when we have a funding crunch and we have to start diverting money. I think this year the political pressure was really on. I think for whatever reason, Brian Kemp decided that vouchers, whether it was because the big donors from out of state care about vouchers, but I think that the pressure came from the governor and the GOP leadership to those reluctant rural legislators, and at least half of them, I think, changed their votes, and that enabled the bill to pass this year.
Yeah, Maureen,
so
I,
the thing that's
ahead.
So amazing to me is
go ahead, please.
Finish. I was going to say this. I just don't. It's so amazing to have a bill that the rank and file voters really don't care about. But, you know, those of us down the legislature are often amazed that at these hearings, it's just a few lobbyists and some poor soul they dragged in who usually has nothing relevant to say to the bill, but agreed to speak. And that was the story with vouchers. There really is not a large outcry from the parent base in the state of Georgia for vouchers.
And Maureen, real quickly, because we got to get to a break, we should point out that last year, you point out, this bill failed. And one of the reasons it did is that Governor Kemp didn't jump on board until the very last moments of the session. This year, it was one of his top priorities from the very beginning. And I think that contributes to what you're talking about here, the pressure that even those rural legislators whose constituents don't have many private schools to be able to send their children to made a difference. We do have to get to a break, Maureen. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And I hope that our listeners are reading your Get Schooled column in the AJC, because it's really, really a smart way to stay informed about what's really going on with education in our state and beyond. Thanks so much, Maureen. This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm Bill Nigut, along with Tia Mitchell in Washington. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from the AJC politics team. Just go to AJC.com/newsletters and sign up today. That's AJC.com/newsletters. Tia Mitchell and I continue now with the AJC's Politically Georgia, and we bring in a man who's done our show with some regularity. Those of you who used to listen to our previous show know Rick Dent as having had an extraordinary career in state government and politics. He worked for three different Southern Democratic governors, the last one being Zell Miller. He's a political consultant who works across the aisle at times. And Rick, well, there are so many things we could talk to you about today. But first of all, welcome to the show. And I want to start by picking up on the Maureen Downey conversation. And I want to put the vouchers that are now in law in the context of the Hope Scholarship and pre-K funding passed by Zell Miller, who you worked for when all that was happening. And here's what I want to mention about that. Zell Miller had a brilliant idea about funding, especially for the Hope Scholarship. He said in his legislation, the state was not able, it would be funded by lottery dollars, and the state would not be allowed to reduce the amount of money that the legislature put toward higher education as an excuse because they had the lottery funds that they could use instead. That's a mistake that Florida made, and the whole thing almost collapsed. So Zell actually anticipated that education was going to continue to need maximum amount of funding, even with that Hope Scholarship in place. That is not what happens with the voucher program, Rick.
Yes and no. Most people are opposed to vouchers, period. I get the taking away from, but you can also make the counter argument that the lottery money could have gone into the education budget and funded everything they wanted to. But Zell built a wall because that was the mistake that most states made. But on its face, and nobody noticed, even Democrats, HOPE and Pre-K are voucher programs. The money goes to those students. So if you want to argue that the voucher program will not work on its face, I think HOPE and Pre-K tell you something different.
Well, again, neither of those programs takes money out of the general education fund that schools across the state rely on in addition to their local funding. But, you know, we could go on about that forever.
But one last thing, what they did is they created market forces that raised the level of education everywhere, both with schools offering pre-K and look at the standards of our colleges and universities now.
Yeah, well, we do know that HOPE and pre-K have been enormous successes. And I just wanted to point out, though, that I do think there is a difference. Tia, you know Rick Dent has done crisis communication for all three of the governors he worked for, certainly after Zell Miller passed the lottery bill. It almost cost him re-election, so Rick Dent knows how to work on those issues. And I thought, Tia, when we talked at the beginning of the show about what Morehouse could end or have to deal with, I thought what Rick had to say about that might be pretty interesting in terms of how the administration would have to handle that, Tia.
Yeah, Rick, you worked for, I think, Democrats that are really much along the lines of a Joe Biden. We know that Joe Biden is facing some headways when it comes to young voters, voters of color, voters who are not happy with how the administration has handled Israel's conflict with Hamas, particularly when it comes to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. If you were, you know, advising the Biden campaign, how would you have them approach this this speech at Morehouse, and how would you have them approach the fact that there could be protests?
Well, you know, the good news is the Secret Service doesn't play. I can tell you that from experience. So nobody's going to be close to the president. That's the good news. And you know, protesters show up everywhere. You know, I think the bigger question, some people are saying, you know, why is he even doing it? And the problem that incumbents in trouble have is, if you use the standard that people are going to yell at you and people don't like you wherever you go, you're never going to go anywhere. And the problem with an incumbent in trouble is you're not going to be hitting home runs. You're moving a boulder up the side of a mountain an inch a day. And so you've got a figure going to Morehouse. They will score a few inches. It's not going to be home runs. But look, they have a serious problem with African-American voters, especially men. If they don't fix that, they will not win. So they have to do things like this, regardless of the Israeli policy and the protests. What they have to make sure, and I'm sure Secret Service will be working on this, is working with Morehouse to make sure nothing wrong happens while the president is in safety speaking. And that's the real crisis for Morehouse, how they handled those students that day with law enforcement, with what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do. How Morehouse looks and how they handle it is probably more dangerous than what the impact's going to be on Joe Biden.
So, Rick, that's an important point. But stepping back from personal safety for the president, just talking about what it might be like in the auditorium as the president speaks, it is certainly potentially likely that there are going to be people standing up, yelling about Gaza, about what they will say is genocidal behavior by the Israelis that the president is endorsing, essentially. So that raises this question of whether or not the president can get much of anything out of this if, in fact, the message that comes out of it is he was shouted down by pro-Palestinian demonstrators.
See, I have no idea how Morehouse plans to handle access. And that's going to be critical. I would imagine there is some work to control access in terms of reducing the number of problems that might enter. I don't know how you do that. I would certainly have the president's people trying to talk to as many student organizations as possible to try to figure out what is it that you want, what is it that you need. We need a balance of First Amendment, but you know, the president has First Amendment rights as well. So what's the balance here? What Morehouse really needs to work on to reduce is surprises. Surprises scare people. Surprises scare the Secret Service. Surprises scare the president. Surprises will scare the students. Yeah. So as much as they can all work out basically their theater that they all want to accomplish that day, the better. And that means open dialogue and communication between both sides.
Tia, we talked the other day about you being a proud graduate of an HBCU. And so I can't help but wonder, to what extent when a president, in this case Biden, we already know there are black voters out there who think they are treated as sure votes for the Democrats without Democrats doing much really for the black community. And I wonder to what extent there might be a concern that a visit like this is almost a token visit to show President Biden in a sea of black faces.
Well, that's definitely a concern. And when we were talking with Aisha on Monday, I don't know, you know, I kind of mentioned that we had heard rumors that Biden mm-hmm. would be coming to Atlanta. And those were the rumors about Morehouse. And that rumor was spread at least partially by a viral Instagram post, which basically said Biden decided to come to Morehouse after he saw Donald Trump at Chick-fil-A near the colleges. Yeah. And I don't think there may be some level of truth that's like that ratcheted up the discussions, but we can be clear that the invitation from Morehouse definitely has been months in the making. You can't just do this kind of stuff on a dime. But there is that kind of, some folks are saying, you know, is Biden just coming so he can be seen with young college students? Now, at the end of the day, isn't that what campaigning is all about? So, yeah, he's coming so he can be seen with young black college students, like any other politician since the history of politics, going to communities that they need for an election. But the cynicism will come if people don't think Biden has their best interest at heart in a genuine way. That's where the cynicism comes about Trump at that Chick-fil-A. You know, so yes, there will always be people there for the photo op, but if the political class, the grassroots organizers, those who definitely can facilitate a win or a loss, they have to believe Biden is genuine. And I think a lot of black voters believe Biden is genuine in a lot of ways, but he does still have room for improvement on certain topics and with certain types of voters.
Yeah. Rick, I want to move on because we did invite you to also talk with us about the latest news about polling in the presidential race. Numbers are always hard to do on the radio because it's hard to grab them in your head. So let me just talk in more generalities. The most recent Fox News poll, which came out, I think, at the end of last week, shows Donald Trump ahead of President Biden by 5 or 6 points, which is fairly close to what the AJC's last poll had. If those polls are both pretty accurate, it means Biden has not made much progress here in Georgia. But at the same time, a number of national polls that have come out in the last few days show that Biden actually is moving up a bit on President Trump. In some states, they're almost tied. I think in Wisconsin, another key state, they're basically tied. How do you see this race? We know polling is a snapshot of a moment, and we know people are skeptical about polls. Nevertheless, they do give people who are involved directly in politics, as you've been, people like us as journalists, some kind of compass to look at. What are these polls telling you right now?
I think it's amazing how remarkably static that they have been when you consider all the chaos that has been going on in this country in the last year, all the margin of error. Remember, and this is for, I know you guys know this, this is more for your listeners. You read incumbent polls different than open seat poll, because an incumbent race is a referendum on the incumbent. Open seat is completely different. So undecideds almost always break against the incumbent, number one. Number two, we're not a popular vote country. So yes, it's fun to watch the horse race, but what is going on in those states? And if you look at the states, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, Nevada, Trump, 3 to 5 points. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of numbers to focus on. And then finally, two other things, regardless of what poll you're looking at, what professionals look at the most in a campaign are two numbers, right track, wrong track. And right now it's 64% wrong track for Biden, and job approval for Biden, which is at 40%, because those are common sense numbers. If 40% of Americans think you did a good job, why would a majority vote to rehire you? Mm-hmm. You would have to have a lot of people move over. So those, if you're looking at polls, those are the two numbers to look at, right track, wrong track, and job. And that tells you almost everything you need to know, and that Joe Biden is
in some trouble. Yeah, Tia, I think Rick just framed it in a way that's fascinating to me, that an incumbent, that an election is really a referendum on the job an incumbent has done. What's interesting about that, Tia, is that the Biden campaign would like to frame Trump as an incumbent, too, and try to convince people what a poor job they think he did, a chaotic job he did as president. They would like it to be a battle between two incumbents and a referendum on how each of them have handled the job. But please go ahead and make your point.
That was kind of what I was going to bring up to Rick, because at the end of the day, it is a referendum between two incumbents. Voters do have 4 years of Biden to compare with 4 years of Trump. Now, it's different because, you know, you can't have two incumbents at the same time. So we have 4 years of Trump. That is, we're now 4 years removed from, in essence. But that does create a contrast, because Trump is more of a known entity than what your usual challenger to an incumbent would be, who's saying, give me a chance. I've never had this office before, but I think I can do better than the guy who's currently there. So, Rick, my question to you is, as someone who's worked across the aisle and isn't very, you're not a progressive, you're more of a tried and true moderate. What are you looking for? Have you made your decision, and who are you supporting? Or if you haven't, what factors are you looking at?
Oh, yeah, I'm Joe Biden 100%. I'm just concerned that maybe the Democrats have nominated the one person who cannot beat Donald Trump. What is fascinating to me about this race, and I've been in races like this before, you know, both men are not liked. Their approvals, disapprovals are in the mid-50s. So nobody wants to go to the polls to vote for either one of these guys. And there's going to be a lot of holding your nose to vote here. But yeah, I'm 100% Joe Biden, but I can be really tough on those numbers because I'm trying to be as objective as possible.
Well, Rick, what you just pointed out is exactly what one of the takeaways was from another new poll, NBC, which found so little interest among voters in casting ballots. NBC says less interest than they've seen in any recent election in modern times.
Well, you know, again, in common sense, if half of the nation hates both of these guys, why would they be excited to go to the polls in November? I think that's pretty common sense. The problem there for Democrats is, I think conventional wisdom is, low turnout probably helps Donald Trump, which is another hurdle for the Democrats.
Real quick, because we got to take a break. Can Biden win Georgia? Or is Georgia increasingly out of reach? Well, I don't mean, of course, we don't know definitively, but what do you think the landscape is today in terms of Democrats' hope that this really is a purple state that has an opportunity to reelect Joe Biden?
Well, it's only been purple in a couple of rare moments.
Right.
if the election was today, no, he couldn't. But the good news for Biden is we got a long way to go. It's April. You know, you got conventions. We used to have bounces. I don't know if we're going to have that this time. We used to have convention bounces. Again, it's all got. Well, he's got to fix the African American vote. And then it's going to come down to white college educated women in the suburbs.
Rick Dent, I wish, you know, we always appreciate your insights. Your experience is always valuable to us on this show. No, it is, Rick Dent. I see you on Zoom kind of giving me this funny look.
Finger.
Thank you, Rick, for being here. Tia, we should point out, as long as Rick mentioned convention bounces, the Politically Georgia team will be at both the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee and the Democratic National Convention in my hometown, Chicago, this summer, broadcasting out of both of those conventions. All right, we got to get to our final break. Thanks again, Rick Dent. Back with more in just a moment. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The AJC has a special offer for Politically Georgia podcast listeners. If you subscribe today, you can get 3 months of unlimited digital access for just 99 cents. That includes all the breaking news, politics, investigations, business, sports, food and dining, and more. Plus, you'll have access to our e-paper, the AJC app, and our assortment of newsletters. So take advantage of this special offer for podcast listeners only by going to ajc.com/starta. That's ajc.com/starta. And by the way, this introductory special is for new subscribers only. Tia Mitchell joins me as co-host of today's show from Washington. Tia, we haven't had a chance to really talk about the vote on Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan funding. The Senate passed it last night, so it's on its way to... There's no reconciliation involved at this point, right? It goes right to the president's desk.
Yeah, President Biden is actually kind of, as we're on live right now, he should be delivering remarks from the White House about signing that bill. It went straight to him. Yeah, he's live now talking about that bill signing. It wasn't amended. Well, he hasn't started yet, but right. At any moment he'll be live talking about that becoming law because it was sent to him immediately.
Talk about the Georgia delegation and the votes there. We know that Marjorie Taylor Greene has been adamantly opposed to Ukraine funding. She wants to oust Mike Johnson because he's supported it. But she's not alone in opposing the funding bill. And we have a Democrat who opposed one portion of the bill as well. So one of the measures. So talk to us about that.
Yeah. So in the House, it was divided up so that members of the House could vote for the parts they liked, not vote for the parts they disliked. And the money for Israel was among the most popular of the four kind of votes they had to take on the package. But there were roughly 60 members who voted no on the money for Israel, a combination of hard right Republicans and progressive Democrats. So we saw that Hank Johnson was among the Democrats who opposed the money for Israel, again, because of his concerns about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and he believes that the United States should not continue supporting Israel while it continues to invade cities in Gaza in retaliation for the October 7th attacks. On the Republican side, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Andrew Clyde voted against all of the foreign aid partially because they oppose it for their, again, they believe it should be coupled with strict border security legislation. I think there are some Republicans who also just wanted to send a message to Speaker Mike Johnson how upset they were. But the package was sent as one complete unit to the Senate. So the Senate did not have the freedom to vote for certain aspects that they liked. They had to either take it or leave it. All or nothing. And so the Senate vote was bipartisan, 79 in favor, 18 opposed. Our senators, Warnock and Ossoff, both voted with the majority, mm-hmm. and all but one, all but three Democrats supported it.
Tia, it's interesting to think about the contrast between Democrat Hank Johnson in the House and Raphael Warnock in the Senate. Warnock has been very clear, and I think rather articulate, in the way he has talked about humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza. I think he's made it quite clear that that's very important to him. He talked with it, as you reported in your interview with him when he came back from Italy. He talked about it with Pope Francis on his private audience in the Vatican. So he's found a way both support Israel with his vote and yet be very outspoken about the need for more humanitarian aid for Gaza. And I wonder how will that serve him well as opposed to a Hank Johnson who votes no for Israeli aid. It's an interesting contrast.
Well, I would say that let's start with Hank Johnson.
Sure.
He's already known as a very progressive Democrat. I don't think anyone's surprised that he opposed this money. And again, it's not because of it. I think people who disagree with that, there are a lot of progressive Democrats who applauded it. And along those same lines, yes, Warnock is pretty popular among Democrats, but you can look on his replies on social media. There are plenty of people who aren't happy that he supported this legislation and that he's championed being an ally of Israel. He talks about that. He says, you know, I'm concerned about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, but I believe that Israel has a right to defend itself and America should support its ally in Israel. The fact that he's kind of threading that needle, not all progressives are happy with Warnock. And he's had to deal with that as well. Now, he's told me he said the fact that this is so polarizing almost gives him a freedom to vote his conscience because he knows no matter what, there are going to be critics on either side of what he does. So he says he's voting his conscience by both speaking out about the crisis in Gaza, but also saying he supports Israel.
I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it. He's free to vote the way he believes. Because for so many people, this is a zero-sum game. You either support Israel or you support the Palestinian people in Gaza, not Hamas. I mean, I know there are some extremists out there. We've seen them on college campuses who are supporting Hamas. But to say I believe in humanitarian aid and support for Israel, which has a right to defend itself and to respond to the horrific October 7th attacks, there are people who are just not going to accept it. And so it does sort of free you up to do what you think is right.
Yep. And that's where, again, a lot of politicians on both sides of the aisle, quite frankly, are right now. But again, we see both on the far right and the far left, there are some voters who want it to be, again, all or nothing, zero sum. I think, unfortunately, it's not, number one, it's not practical from an international relations standpoint. And these parties are having a hard time getting on one accord because people are becoming not just partisan Republican versus Democrat, but very entrenched in their beliefs within the party in ways that are really making it hard for parties to remain unified.
Real quick, you got about 10 seconds for this answer. It appears that the backlash on Marjorie Taylor Greene within her own party. I know she's got supporters on Mike Johnson's ousting, but it appears there are more Republicans who are starting to really have grown tired with Marjorie Taylor Greene. What's your 10-second take on that?
I know 10 seconds. Our colleague Jamie Dupree really dug into that in an article, but I think there is that split between the the white Christian nationalist ideals and supporting President Donald Trump.
Tia Mitchell, always really appreciate your perspective from up there on Capitol Hill. Terrific to have you talk about it with us today. That's it. That's all the time we have for today's podcast. You can hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta, or do as you're doing right now. Follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app. You'll hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop store.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at AJC.com/hip-hop.